This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Before the Fall, written by Noah Hawley, read by Robert Petkoff. For Kyle. A private plane sits on a runway in Martha's Vineyard, forward stairs deployed. It is a 9-seat Osprey 700 SL built in 2001 in Wichita, Kansas. Whose plane it is hard to say with real certainty. The ownership of record is a Dutch holding company with a Cayman Island mailing address, but the logo on the fuselage says Gullwing Air. The pilot, James Melody, is British. Charlie Bush, the first officer, is from Odessa, Texas. The flight attendant, Emma Leitner, was born in Mannheim, Germany, to an American Air Force lieutenant and his teenage wife. They moved to San Diego when she was 9. Everyone has their path. The choices they've made. How any two people end up in the same place at the same time is a mystery. You get on an elevator with a dozen strangers. You ride a bus, wait in line for the bathroom. It happens every day. To try to predict the places we'll go and the people we'll meet would be pointless. A soft halogen glow emanates from the louvered forward hatch, nothing like the harsh fluorescent glare you find in commercial planes. 2 weeks from now, in a New York Magazine interview, Scott Burrows will say that the thing that surprised him most about his first trip on a private jet was not the legroom or the full bar, but how personalized the decor felt, as if at a certain income level, air travel is just another form of staying home. It is a balmy night on the Vineyard, 86 degrees with light winds out of the southwest. The scheduled time of departure is 10 p.m. For the last 3 hours, a heavy coastal fog has been building over the Sound, tendrils of dense white creeping slowly across the floodlit tarmac. The Bateman family in their island Range Rover is the first to arrive. Father, David, mother, Maggie, and their two children, Rachel and JJ. It's late August, and Maggie and the kids have been on the Vineyard for the month, with David flying out from New York on the weekends. It's hard for him to get away any more than that, though he wishes he could. David is in the entertainment business, which is what people in his line of work call television news these days. A Roman circus of information and opinions. He is a tall man with an intimidating phone voice. Strangers, upon meeting him, are often struck by the size of his hands. His son JJ has fallen asleep in the car, and as the others start toward the plane, David leans into the back and gently lifts JJ from the car seat, supporting his weight with one arm. The boy instinctively throws his arms around his father's neck, his face slack from slumber. The warmth of his breath sends a chill down David's spine. He can feel the bones of his son's hips in his palm, the spill of legs against his side. At 4, JJ is old enough to know that people die, but still too young to realize that one day, he will be one of them. David and Maggie call him their perpetual motion machine, because really it's just non-stop all day long. At 3, JJ's primary means of communication was to roar like a dinosaur. Now he is the king of the interruption, questioning every word they say with seemingly endless patience until he's answered or shut down. David kicks the car door closed with his foot, his son's weight pulling him off balance. He is holding his phone to his ear with his free hand. "Tell him if he says a word about any of this," he says quietly so as not to wake the boy. "We'll sue him biblically until he thinks lawyers are falling out of the sky like frogs." At 56, David wears a hard layer of fat around his frame like a bulletproof vest. He has a strong chin and a good head of hair. In the 1990s, David built a name for himself running political campaigns, governors, senators, and one two-term president. But he retired in 2000 to run a lobbying firm on K Street. 2 years later, an aging billionaire approached him with the idea of starting a 24-hour news network. 13 years and $13 billion in corporate revenue later, David has a top-floor office with bomb-resistant glass and access to the corporate jet. He doesn't get to see the kids enough. David and Maggie both agree on this, though they fight about it regularly. Which is to say, she raises the issue and he gets defensive, even though at heart he feels the same. But then, isn't that what marriage is? Two people fighting for land rights to the same 6 inches? Now, on the tarmac, a gust of wind blows up. David, still on the phone, glances over at Maggie and smiles, and the smile says, "I'm glad to be here with you." It says, "I love you." But it also says, "I know I'm in the middle of another work call, and I need you to give me a break about it." It says, "What matters is that I'm here, and that we're all together." It is a smile of apology, but there is also some steel in it. Maggie smiles back, but hers is more perfunctory, sadder. The truth is, she can no longer control whether she forgives him or not. They've been married less than 10 years. Maggie is 36, a former preschool teacher, the pretty one boys fantasize about before they even understand what that means, a breast fixation shared by toddler and teen. Miss Maggie, as they called her, was cheerful and loving. She came in early every morning at 6:30 to straighten up. She stayed late to write progress reports and work on her lesson plan. Miss Maggie was a 26-year-old girl from Piedmont, California, who loved teaching. Loved it. She was the first adult any of these 3-year-olds had met who took them seriously, who listened to what they had to say and made them feel grown. Fate, if you would call it that, brought Maggie and David together in a ballroom at the Waldorf Astoria one Thursday night in early spring 2005. The ball was a black tie fundraiser for an educational fund. Maggie was there with a friend. David was on the board. She was the humble beauty in a floral dress with blue finger paint smeared on the small curve inside her right knee. He was the heavyweight charm shark in a 2-button suit. She wasn't the youngest woman at the party, or even the prettiest, but she was the only one with chalk in her purse, the only one who could build a papier-mâché volcano, and owned a striped cat-in-the-hat stovepipe hat she would wear to work every year on Dr. Seuss's birthday. In other words, she was everything David had ever wanted in a wife. He excused himself and made his approach, smiling a cap-toothed smile. In retrospect, she never had a chance. 10 years later, they have 2 children and a townhouse on Gracie Square. Rachel, 9 years old, goes to Brearley with 100 other girls. Maggie, retired from teaching now, stays home with JJ, which makes her unusual among women of her station, the carefree housewives of workaholic millionaires. When she strolls her son to the park in the morning, Maggie is the only stay-at-home mother in the playground. All the other kids arrive in European-designed strollers pushed by island ladies on cell phones. Now, on the airport runway, Maggie feels a chill run through her and pulls her summer cardigan tighter. The tendrils of fog have become a slow, roiling surf, drafting with glacial patience across the tarmac. "Are you sure it's okay to fly in this?" she asks her husband's back. He has reached the top of the stairs where Emma Leitner, their flight attendant, wearing a trim blue skirt suit, greets him with a smile.
"It'll be fine, Mom," says Rachel, 9, walking behind her mother. "It's not like they need to see to fly a plane." "No, I know. They have instruments."
Maggie gives her daughter a supportive smile. Rachel is wearing her green backpack, Hunger Games, Barbies, and iPad inside, and as she walks, it bumps rhythmically against the small of her back. Such a big girl. Even at 9, there are signs of the woman she'll become. A professor who waits patiently as you figure out your own mistakes. The smartest person in the room, in other words, but not a show-off. Never a show-off. With a good heart and musical laughter. The question is, are these qualities she was born with, or qualities seeded inside her by what happened? The true crime of her youth.
Somewhere online, the entire saga is recorded in words and pictures, archived news footage on YouTube, hundreds of man-hours of beat reporting, all stored in the great collective memory of ones and zeros. A New Yorker writer wanted to do a book last year, but David quashed it quietly. Rachel is only a child, after all. Sometimes when Maggie thinks about what could have gone wrong, she worries her heart will crack. Instinctively, she glances over at the Range Rover, where Gil is radioing the advance team. Gil is their shadow, a big Israeli who never takes off his jacket. He is what people in their income bracket call domestic security. 6'2", 190 pounds. There is a reason he never takes off his jacket, a reason that doesn't get discussed in polite circles. This is Gil's fourth year with the Bateman family. Before Gil, there was Misha. And before Misha came the strike team of humorless men in suits, the ones with automatic weapons in the trunk of their car. In her school teacher days, Maggie would have scoffed at this kind of military intrusion into family life. She would have called it narcissistic to think that money made you a target for violence. But that was before the events of July 2008, before her daughter's kidnapping, and the agonizing 3 days it took to get her back. On the jet stairs, Rachel spins and gives a mock royal wave to the empty runway. She is wearing blue fleece over her dress, her hair in a bowed ponytail. Any evidence that Rachel has been damaged by those 3 days remains mostly hidden. A fear of small spaces, a certain trepidation around strange men. But then Rachel has always been a happy kid, a bubbly trickster with a sly smile, and though she can't understand how, Maggie is thankful every day that her kid hasn't lost that. "Good evening, Mrs. Bateman," says Emma as Maggie reaches the top of the airplane stairs. "Hi. Thanks," says Maggie reflexively. She feels the usual need to apologize for their wealth, not her husband's, necessarily, but her own. The sheer implausibility of it. She was a preschool teacher not so long ago, living in a 6-story walk-up with 2 mean girls, like Cinderella. "Is Scott here yet?" she asks. "No, ma'am. You're the first to arrive. I've pulled a bottle of Pinot Gris. Would you like a glass?" "Not right now. Thanks." Inside, the jet is a statement of subdued luxury, contoured walls ribbed with sleek ash paneling. The seats are gray leather and laid out casually in pairs, as if to suggest you might enjoy the flight more with a partner. The cabin has a moneyed hush, like the inside of a presidential library. Though she's flown this way many times, Maggie still can't get over the indulgence of it. An entire airplane just for them. David lays their son in his seat, covers him with a blanket. He is on another call already, this one clearly serious. Maggie can tell by the grim set of David's jaw. Below him, the boy stirs in his seat, but doesn't wake. Rachel stops by the cockpit to talk to the pilots. It is something she does everywhere she goes, seeks out the local authority, and grills them for information. Maggie spots Gil at the cockpit door, keeping the 9-year-old in sight. He carries, in addition to a handgun, a taser and plastic handcuffs. He is the quietest man Maggie has ever met. Phone to his ear, David gives his wife's shoulder a squeeze.
"Excited to get back?" he asks, covering the mouthpiece with his other hand.
"Mixed," she says. "It's so nice out here."
"You could stay. I mean, we have that thing next weekend, but otherwise, why not?"
"No," she says. "The kids have school, and I've got the museum board thing on Thursday." She smiles at him. "I didn't sleep that well," she says. "I'm just tired." David's eyes go to something over Maggie's shoulder. He frowns. Maggie turns. Ben and Sarah Kipling stand at the top of the stairs. They're a wealthy couple, more David's friends than hers. All the same, Sarah squeals when she sees Maggie.
"Darling!"
she says, throwing open her arms. Sarah gives Maggie a hug, the flight attendant standing awkwardly behind them, holding a tray of drinks.
I love your dress, says Sarah.
Ben maneuvers past his wife and charges David, shaking his hand vigorously. He is a partner at one of the big four Wall Street firms, a blue-eyed shark in a tailored blue button-down shirt and a pair of belted white shorts.
Did you see the fucking game? He says. How does he not catch that ball?
Don't get me started, says David.
I mean, I could have caught that fucking ball, and I got French toast hands.
The two men stand toe-to-toe, mock posturing, two big bucks locking horns for the sheer love of battle.
He lost it in the lights, David tells him,
then feels his phone buzz. He looks at it, frowns, types a reply. Ben glances quickly over his shoulder, his expression sobering. The women are busy chatting. He leans in closer.
We need to talk, buddy.
David shakes him off, still typing.
Not now.
I've been calling you, Kipling says. He starts to say more, but Emma is there with drinks.
Glenlivet on the rocks, if I'm not mistaken, she says, handing Ben a glass.
You're a doll,
Ben says, and knocks back half the scotch in one gulp.
Just water for me, David says as she lifts a glass of vodka from the tray.
Of course, she says, smiling. I'll be right back.
A few feet away, Sarah Kipling has already run out of small talk. She gives Maggie's arm a squeeze.
How are you?
She says earnestly, and for the second time.
No, I'm good, says Maggie. I just travel days, you know. I'll be happy when we're home. I know. I mean, I love the beach, but honestly, I get so bored. How many sunsets can you watch and not want to just, I don't know, go to Barney's?
Maggie glances nervously at the open hatch. Sarah catches the look.
Waiting for someone? No, I mean, I think we'll be one more, but...
Her daughter saves her from having to say more.
Mom,
says Rachel from her seat,
don't forget tomorrow is Tamara's party. We still have to get a gift.
Okay, says Maggie, distracted. Let's go to Dragonfly in the morning. Looking past her daughter, Maggie sees David and Ben huddled together talking. David doesn't look happy. She could ask him about it later, but her husband has been so standoffish lately, and the last thing she wants is a fight. The flight attendant glides past her and hands David his water.
Lime,
she says. David shakes his head. Ben rubs his bald spot nervously. He glances at the cockpit.
Are we waiting for somebody? He says. Let's get this show on the road.
One more person, says Emma, looking at her list. Scott Burrows?
Ben glances at David.
Who?
David shrugs.
Maggie has a friend, he says.
He's not a friend, Maggie says, overhearing. I mean, the kids know him. We rented him this morning at the market. He said he had to go to New York, so I invited him to join us. I think he's a painter.
She looks at her husband.
I showed you some of his work.
David checks his watch.
You told him 10 o'clock?
He says. She nods.
Well, he says, sitting. 5 more minutes and he'll have to catch the ferry like everyone else.
Through a round portal window, Maggie sees the captain standing on the tarmac examining the wing. He stares up at the smooth aluminum, then walks slowly toward the plane. Behind her, JJ shifts in slumber, his mouth slack. Maggie rearranges the blanket over him, then gives his forehead a kiss. He always looks so worried when he sleeps, she thinks. Over the chair back, she sees the captain re-enter the plane. He comes over to shake hands, a man quarterback tall with a military build.
Gentlemen, he says, ladies, welcome. Should be a short flight, some light winds, but otherwise the ride'll be pretty smooth.
I saw you outside the plane, says Maggie.
Routine visual inspection, he tells her. I do it before every flight. The plane looks good.
What about the fog?
Asks Maggie.
Her daughter rolls her eyes.
Fog isn't a factor with a sophisticated piece of machinery like this, the pilot tells them. A few hundred feet above sea level, and we're past it.
I'm going to eat some of this cheese, then, says Ben. Should we put on some music, maybe? Or the TV? I think Boston's playing the White Sox.
Emma goes to find the game on the in-flight entertainment system, and there is a long moment of settling in as they take their seats and stow their belongings. Up front, the pilots run through their pre-flight instrument check. David's phone buzzes again. He checks it, frowns.
All right, says David, getting antsy. I think that's all the time we've got for the painter.
He nods to Emma, who crosses to close the main cabin door. In the cockpit, as if by telepathy, the pilot starts the engines. The front door is almost closed when they hear a man's voice yell, "Wait!" The plane shakes as their final passenger climbs the gangway stairs. Despite herself, Maggie feels herself flush, a thrum of anticipation starting in her belly. And then he is there, Scott Burrows, mid-40s, looking flushed and out of breath. His hair is shaggy and starting to gray, but his face is smooth. There are worn gouache splotches on his white keds, faded white and summer blue. He has a dirty green duffel bag over one shoulder. In his bearing there is still the flush of youth, but the lines around his eyes are deep and earned.
Sorry, he says. The cab took forever. I ended up taking a bus.
Well, you made it, says David, nodding to the co-pilot to close the door. That's what matters.
Can I take your bag, sir? Says Emma.
What?
Says Scott, startled momentarily by the stealthy way she has moved next to him.
No, I got it.
She points him to an empty seat. As he walks to it, he takes in the interior of the plane for the first time.
Well, hell, he says. Ben Kipling, says Ben, rising to shake Scott's hand.
Yeah, says Scott. Scott Burrows.
He sees Maggie.
Hey, he says, giving her a wide, warm grin.
Thanks again for this. Maggie smiles back, flushed.
It's nothing, she says. We had room.
Scott falls into a seat next to Sarah. Before he even has his seatbelt on, Emma is handing him a glass of wine.
Oh, he says. No, thank you. I don't... Some water, maybe?
Emma smiles, withdraws. Scott looks over at Sarah.
You could get used to this, huh?
Truer words have never been spoken, says Kipling.
The engines surge, and Maggie feels the plane start to move. Captain Melody's voice comes over the speakers.
Ladies and gentlemen, please prepare for takeoff, he says.
Maggie looks over at her two kids, Rachel sitting with one leg folded under her, scrolling through songs on her phone, and little JJ hunched in slumber, slack-faced with childish oblivion. As she does at a thousand random moments out of every day, Maggie feels a swell of motherly love, ballooning and desperate. They are her life, these children. Her identity. She reaches once more to readjust her son's blanket, and as she does, there is that moment of weightlessness as the plane's wheels leave the ground. This act of impossible hope, this routine suspension of the physical laws that hold men down, inspires and terrifies her. Flying. They are flying. And as they rise up through the foggy white, talking and laughing, serenaded by the songs of 1950s crooners and the white noise of the long at-bat, none of them has any idea that 16 minutes from now, their plane will crash into the sea.
1.
When he was 6, Scott Burrows took a trip to San Francisco with his family. They spent 3 days at a motel near the beach. Scott, his parents, and his sister June, who would later drown in Lake Michigan. San Francisco was foggy and cold that weekend, wide avenues rolling like tongue tricks down to the water. Scott remembers his father ordering crab legs at a restaurant and how, when they came, they were monstrous, the size of tree branches, as if the crabs should be eating them instead of the other way around. On the last day of their trip, Scott's dad got them on a bus down to Fisherman's Wharf. Scott, in faded corduroys and a striped T-shirt, knelt on the sloped plastic seat and watched as the flat, wide stucco of the Sunset District turned to concrete hills and wide plank Victorians lining the Sirius incline. They went to the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum and had their caricatures drawn, a family of four comically oversized heads bobbling side by side on unicycles. Afterward, they stopped and watched the seals splay themselves on salt-soaked docks. Scott's mother pointed at flurries of white-winged gulls with wonder in her eyes. They were landlocked people. To Scott, it was as if they had taken a spaceship to a distant planet. For lunch, they ate corn dogs and drank Coke out of comically large plastic cups. Entering Aquatic Park, they found a crowd had gathered. There were dozens of people looking north and pointing toward Alcatraz. The bay was slate gray that day, the hills of Marin framing the now-defunct prison island like the shoulders of a guard. To their left, the Golden Gate Bridge was a hazy, burnt-orange giant, suspension towers headless in the late morning fog. Scott could see a mass of small boats circling out on the water.
"Was there an escape?" Scott's father asked aloud to no one.
Scott's mother frowned and pulled out a brochure. As far as she knew, she said, the prison was closed. The island was just for tourists now. Scott's father tapped the man next to him on the shoulder.
"What are we looking at?" he asked.
"He's swimming over from Alcatraz," the man said.
"Who?"
"The exercise guy. What's it? Jack LaLanne. It's some kind of stunt. He's handcuffed and pulling a goddamn boat."
"What do you mean, pulling a boat?"
"There's a rope. This is off the radio. See that boat there? The big one? He's got to drag that thing all the way over here."
The guy shook his head like all of a sudden the world had gone insane on him. Scott climbed to a higher step where he could see over all the adults. There was indeed a large boat out on the water, bow pointed toward shore. It was surrounded by a fleet of smaller boats. A woman leaned down and tapped Scott's arm.
"Here," she said, smiling. "Take a look."
She handed Scott a small pair of binoculars. Through the lenses, he could just make out a man in the water, wearing a beige swim cap. His shoulders were bare. He swam in surging forward lunges like a mermaid.
"The current is nuts right there," the man told Scott's father. "Not to mention the damn water is like 58 degrees. There's a reason nobody ever escaped from Alcatraz. Plus you got the sharks. I give the guy one shot in five."
Through the binoculars, Scott could see that the motorboats surrounding the swimmer were filled with men in uniforms. They were carrying rifles and staring down into the chop. In the water, the swimmer lifted his arms from the surf and surged forward. He was bound at the wrists, focused on the shore. His breathing was steady. If he was aware of the deputies or the risk of shark attack, he didn't show it. Jack LaLanne, the fittest man on earth. His 60th birthday was in 5 days. 60. The age where anyone with sense slows down, puts up their feet, and lets a few things slide. But, as Scott would later learn, Jack's discipline transcended age. He was a tool constructed to complete a task, an overcoming machine. Around his waist, the rope was like a tentacle trying to pull him down into the cold, black deep. But he paid it no mind, as if by ignoring the weight he was pulling, he could take away its power. Jack was used to it anyway, this rope. At home, he tied himself to the side of the pool and swam in place for half an hour a day. This was in addition to 90 minutes of weightlifting and 30 minutes of running. Looking at himself in the mirror afterward, Jack didn't see a mortal man. he saw a being of pure energy. He had done this swim before, too, back in 1955. Alcatraz was still a prison then, a cold rock of penitence and punition. Jack was 41, a young buck already famous for being fit. He had the TV show and the gyms. Every week, he stood in simple black and white wearing his trademark jumpsuit, tailored skin tight, his biceps bulging. Every so often, without warning, he would drop to the floor and punctuate his advice with 100 fingertip push-ups. Fruits and vegetables, he'd say. Protein. Exercise. On NBC, Mondays at 8, Jack gave away the secrets of eternal life. All you had to do was listen. Towing the boat now, he remembered that first swim. They said it couldn't be done. A 2-mile swim against strong ocean currents in 50-degree water. But Jack did it in just under an hour. Now, 19 years later, he was back, hands tied, legs bound, 1,000-pound boat chained to his waist. In his mind, there was no boat. There was no current. There were no sharks. There was only his will. "Ask the guys who are doing serious triathlons," he would later say, "if there are any limits to what can be done. The limit is right here in your head. You've got to get physically fit between the ears. Muscles don't know anything. They have to be taught." Jack was the puny kid with the pimples who gorged himself on sweets, the pup who went sugar mad one day and tried to kill his brother with an axe. Then came the epiphany, the burning bush resolve. In a flash it came to him. He would unlock his body's full potential. He would remake himself entirely, and by doing so, change the world. And so, chubby, sugar-brained Jack invented exercise. He became the hero who could do 1,000 jumping jacks and 1,000 chin-ups in 90 minutes. The muscle that trained itself to finish 1,033 push-ups in 20 minutes by climbing a 25-foot rope with 140 pounds of weight strapped to his belt. Everywhere he went, people came up to him on the street. It was the early days of television. He was part scientist, part magician, part god. "I can't die," Jack told people. "It would ruin my image." Now, in the water, he lunged forward using the flopping butterfly stroke that he'd invented. The shore was in sight, news cameras massing by the water. The crowd had grown. They spilled over the horseshoe steps. Jack's wife Elaine was among them, a former water ballerina who had chain-smoked and lived on donuts before she met Jack. "There he is," someone said, pointing. A 60-year-old man pulling a boat. Handcuffed. Shackled. He was Houdini, except he wasn't trying to escape. If Jack had his way, he would be chained to this boat forever. They'd add a new one every day until he was pulling the whole world behind him, until he was carrying all of us on his back into a future where human potential was limitless. "Age is a state of mind," he told people. That was the secret. He would finish this swim and bound from the surf. He would leap into the air like a boxer after a knockout. Maybe he'd even drop and knock off 100 push-ups. He felt that good. At Jack's age, most men were stooped over, whining about their backs. They were nervous about the end. But not Jack. When he turned 70, he would swim for 70 hours, pulling 70 boats filled with 70 people. When he turned 100, they would rename the country after him. He would wake every morning with a boner of steel until the end of time. On shore, Scott stood on tiptoes and stared out at the water. His parents were forgotten. The lunch he hadn't liked. There was nothing on earth now except the scene before him. The boy watched as the man in the swim cap struggled against the tide. Stroke after stroke, muscle against nature, willpower in defiance of witless primal forces. The crowd was on its feet, urging the swimmer on, stroke by stroke, inch by inch, until Jack LaLanne was walking out of the surf, newsmen wading out to meet him. He was breathing hard, lips turning blue, but he was smiling. The newsmen untied his wrists, pulled the rope from his waist. The crowd was going crazy. Elaine waded out into the waves, and Jack lifted her into the air as if she were nothing. The waterfront was electrified. People felt like they were witnessing a miracle. For a long time after, they would find themselves believing that anything was possible. They would go through their day feeling elevated. And Scott Burrows, 6 years old, standing on the top step of the bleachers, found himself undone by a strange surge. There was a swelling in his chest, a feeling, elation, wonder, that made him want to weep. Even at his young age, he knew that he had witnessed something unquantifiable, some grand facet of nature that was more than animal. To do what this man had done, to strap weight to his body, bind his limbs, and swim 2 miles through freezing water, was something Superman would do. Was it possible? Was this Superman?
"Al," said his father, ruffling Scott's hair, "that was really something. Wasn't that something?"
But Scott had no words. He just nodded, his eyes fixed on the strong man in the surf, who had picked a news reporter up over his head and was mock-throwing him out into the water.
"I see this guy on TV all the time," his dad said, "but I thought it was just a joke, with the puffed-up muscles. But man!"
He shook his head from wonder.
"Is that Superman?" Scott asked.
"What? No, that's... I mean, just a guy."
Just a guy. Like Scott's dad or Uncle Jake, mustached and pot-bellied. Like Mr. Branch, his gym teacher with the afro. Scott couldn't believe it. Was it possible? Could anyone be Superman if they just put their mind to it? If they were willing to do what it took? Whatever it took? 2 days later, when they got back to Indianapolis, Scott Burrows signed up for swim class. Waves. He surfaces, shouting. It is night. The salt water burns his eyes. Heat singes his lungs. There is no moon, just a diffusion of moonlight through the burly fog, wave caps churning midnight blue in front of him. Around him, eerie orange flames lick the froth. The water is on fire, he thinks, kicking away instinctively. And then, after a moment of shock and disorientation, the plane has crashed. Scott thinks this, but not in words. In his brain are images and sounds. A sudden downward pitch, the panicked stench of burning metal, screams, a woman bleeding from the head, broken glass glittering against her skin, and how everything that wasn't tied down seemed to float for an endless moment as time slowed. A wine bottle, a woman's purse, a little girl's iPhone. Plates of food hovering in midair, spinning gently, entrees still in place. And then the screech of metal on metal, and the barrel roll of Scott's world ripping itself to pieces. A wave smacks him in the face, and he kicks his feet to try to get higher in the water. His shoes are dragging him down, so he loses them, then forces his way out of his salt-soaked chinos. He shivers in the cold Atlantic current, treading water, legs scissoring, arms pushing the ocean away in hard swirls. The waves are quilted with froth, not the hard triangles of children's drawings, but fractals of water, tiny waves stacking into larger ones. Out in the open water, they come at him from all directions, like a pack of wolves testing his defenses. The dying fire animates them, gives them faces of sinister intent. Scott treads his way into a 360-degree turn. Around him, he sees humps of jagged wreckage bobbing, pieces of fuselage, a stretch of wing. The floating gasoline has already dissipated or burned down. Soon, everything will be dark. Fighting panic, Scott tries to assess the situation. The fact that it's August is in his favor. Right now, the temperature of the Atlantic is maybe 65 degrees, cold enough for hypothermia, but warm enough to give him time to reach shore, if that's possible, if he's even close.
Hey!
He shouts, turning himself in the water.
I'm here! I'm alive!
There have to be other survivors, he thinks. How can a plane crash and only one person survive? He thinks about the woman sitting next to him, the banker's chatty wife. He thinks about Maggie with her summer smile. He thinks about the children. Fuck. There were children. Two, yes? A boy and a girl. How old? The girl was bigger. 10, maybe? But the boy was small. A toddler still.
Hello!
He shouts with added urgency, swimming now toward the biggest piece of wreckage. It looks like part of a wing. When he reaches it, the metal is hot to the touch, and he kicks away hard, not wanting to get swept onto it by the waves and burned. Did the plane break up on impact, he wonders? Or did it crack open on the way down, spilling passengers? It seems impossible that he doesn't know, but the data stream of memory is clogged with indecipherable fragments, pictures with no order, and right now he has no time to try to clarify anything. Squinting in the dark, Scott feels himself rising suddenly on a heavy wave. He struggles to stay on top of it, realizing he can no longer avoid the obvious. Straining to stay afloat, he feels something in his left shoulder pop. The ache he endured post-crash becomes a knife that cuts through him whenever he raises his left arm above his head. Kicking his legs, he tries to stretch the pain away like you would a cramp, but it's clear something in the socket is torn or broken. He will have to be careful. He still has partial motion, can manage a decent breaststroke, but if the shoulder gets worse, he could find himself a one-armed man, adrift, injured, a tiny fish in the saltwater belly of a whale. It occurs to him then that he may be bleeding. And that's when the word sharks enters his mind. For a moment there is nothing but pure animal panic. Higher reason evaporates. His heart rate soars, legs kicking wildly. He swallows saltwater and starts to cough. Stop, he tells himself. Slow down. If you panic right now, you will die. He forces himself to be calm, rotating slowly to try to get his bearings. If he could see stars, he thinks, he could orient himself. But the fog is too thick. Should he swim east or west, back toward the vineyard or toward the mainland? And yet, how will he even know which is which? The island he has come from floats like an ice cube in a soup bowl. At this distance, if Scott's trajectory is off by even a few degrees, he could easily swim right past it and never even realize. Better, he thinks, to make for the long arm of the coast. If he keeps his stroke even, Scott thinks, rests occasionally, and doesn't panic, he will hit land eventually. He is a swimmer, after all. No stranger to the sea. You can do this, he tells himself. The thought gives him a surge of confidence. He knows from riding the ferry that Martha's Vineyard is 7 miles from Cape Cod. But their plane was headed to JFK, which means it would have flown south over the open water toward Long Island. How far did they travel? How far are they from shore? Can Scott swim 10 miles with one good arm? 20? He is a land mammal adrift in the open sea. The plane will have sent a distress signal, he tells himself. The Coast Guard is on its way. But even as he thinks this, he realizes that the last flame has gone out, and the debris field is scattering with the current. To keep himself from panicking, Scott thinks of Jack. Jack, the Greek god in his swim trunks, grinning, arms flexed into rippling towers, shoulders hunched forward, lats popped out. The crab. That's what they called it. Snapping a crab. Scott kept his poster on the wall throughout his childhood. He had it there to remind himself that anything was possible. You could be an explorer or an astronaut. You could sail the seven seas, climb the tallest mountain. All you had to do was believe. Underwater, Scott folds himself in half, peeling off his wet socks and flexing his toes against the cool deep. His left shoulder is starting to tighten up on him. He rests it as much as he can, pulling his weight with the right, settling for 15 minutes at a time into a child's dog paddle. Once more, he recognizes the sheer impossibility of what he must do. Choose a direction at random, and swim for who knows how many miles against strong ocean currents with only one working arm. Panic's cousin, Despair, threatens to settle in, but he shakes it off. His tongue is already starting to feel dry in his mouth. Dehydration is another thing he will have to worry about if he's out here long enough. Around him, the wind is picking up, roughing the seas. If I'm going to do this, Scott decides, I need to start swimming now. Once more, he looks for a break in the fog, but there is none. So he closes his eyes for a moment. He tries to feel west, to divine it, like the iron filing feels the magnet. Behind you, he thinks. He opens his eyes, takes a deep breath. He is about to take his first stroke when he hears the noise. At first he thinks it's gulls, a high-pitched ululation that rises and falls. But then the sea lifts Scott a few feet, and at the wave's peak, he realizes with a shock what he's hearing. Crying. Somewhere a child is crying. He spins, trying to pinpoint the sound, but the waves rise and fall unevenly, creating bounces and echoes.
Hey! He calls. Hey, I'm here!
The crying stops.
Hey!
He shouts, kicking against the undercurrent.
Where are you?
He looks for the wreckage, but whatever pieces haven't sunk have floated off in any number of directions. Scott strains to hear, to find the child.
Hey!
He yells again.
I'm here! Where are you?
For a moment, there is just the sound of the waves, and Scott starts to wonder if maybe it was gulls he heard. But then a child's voice comes, sharp and surprisingly close.
Help!
Scott lunges toward the sound. He is no longer alone, no longer a solitary man engaged in an act of self-preservation. Now he is responsible for the life of another. He thinks of his sister, who drowned in Lake Michigan when she was 16, and he swims. He finds the child clinging to a seat cushion 30 feet away. It is the boy. He can't be more than 4.
Hey, says Scott when he reaches him. Hey, sweetie.
His voice catches in his throat as he touches the boy's shoulder, and he realizes he is crying.
I'm here, he says. I've got you.
The seat cushion doubles as a flotation device, with arm straps and a cinch belt, but it is designed for an adult, so Scott has a hard time getting it to stay on the boy, who is shivering from the cold.
I threw up,
the boy says. Scott wipes his mouth gently.
That's okay. You're okay. Just a little seasick.
Where are we?
The little boy asks.
We're in the ocean, Scott tells him. There was a plane crash and we're in the ocean, but I'm gonna swim to shore.
Don't leave me!
The boy says, panic in his voice.
No, no, says Scott. Of course not. I'm taking you with me. We're just going to... I have to get this thing to stay on you. And then I'll... You'll lie on top, and I'll pull you behind me. How does that sound?
The boy nods, and Scott gets to work. It's hard with only one working arm, but after a few torturous moments, he manages to tie the flotation device straps into a weave. He slips the boy into the harness and studies the results. It's not as tight as he'd like, but it should keep the boy above the water.
Okay, says Scott. I need you to hold on tight, and I'm going to pull you to shore. Do you know how to swim?
The kid nods.
Good, says Scott. So if you fall off the cushion, I want you to kick real hard and paddle with your arms, okay?
Dog and cat, says the boy.
That's right. Dog and cat with your hands, just like Mommy taught you.
My daddy.
Sure, just like Daddy taught you, okay?
The boy nods. Scott sees his fear.
Do you know what a hero is? Scott asks him.
He fights the bad guys,
the boy says.
That's right. The hero fights the bad guys, and he never gives up, right?
No.
Well, I need you to be the hero now, okay? Just pretend the waves are the bad guys, and we're going to swim through them. And we can't give up. We won't. We'll just keep swimming until we reach land, okay?
The boy nods. Wincing, Scott loops his left arm through one of the straps. His shoulder is screaming now. Each swell that lifts them adds to his sense of disorientation.
Okay, he says. Let's do this.
Scott closes his eyes and tries once again to feel which way to swim. Behind you, he thinks. The shore is behind you. He rotates carefully around the boy in the water and starts to kick. But just as he does, moonlight breaks through the fog. A patch of starry black is briefly visible overhead. Scott searches desperately for constellations he recognizes, the gap closing quickly. Then he spots Andromeda, and then the Big Dipper, and with it, the North Star.
It's the other way, he realizes with a sickening vertigo.
For a moment, Scott feels an overwhelming urge to vomit. Had the sky not cleared, then he and the boy would have set out into the Atlantic deep, the east coast receding behind them with every kick, until exhaustion overtook them, and they sank without a trace.
Change of plans, he tells the boy, trying to keep his voice light. Let's go the other way.
Okay.
Okay. That's good.
Scott kicks them into position. The farthest he has ever swum is 15 miles, but that was when he was 19, and he had trained for months. Plus, the race was in a lake with no current, and both of his arms worked. Now it's night, and the water temperature is dropping, and he will have to fight the strong Atlantic current for who knows how many miles.
If I survive this, he thinks, I'm going to send Jack LaLanne's widow a fruit basket.
The thought is so ridiculous that, bobbing in the water, Scott starts to laugh, and for a moment can't stop. He thinks of himself standing at the counter of edible arrangements, filling out the card. With deepest affection, Scott.
Stop!
Says the boy, afraid suddenly that his survival is in the hands of a crazy person.
Okay, says Scott, trying to reassure the boy. It's okay. Just a joke I thought of. We're going now.
It takes him a few minutes to find his stroke, a modified breaststroke, pulling water more with the right hand than the left, legs kicking hard. It is a noisy mess, his left shoulder a bag of broken glass. A gnawing worry settles into his gut. They will drown, both of them. They will both be lost to the deep. But then, somehow, a rhythm presents itself. and he begins to lose himself in the repetition. Arm up and in, legs scissoring. He swims into the endless deep, ocean spray in his face. It's hard to keep track of time. What time did the plane take off? 10 p.m.? How much time has passed? 30 minutes? An hour? How long until the sun comes up? 8 hours? 9? Around him, the sea is pockmarked and ever-changing. Swimming, he tries not to think about the great tracts of open water. He tries not to picture the depth of the ocean, or how the Atlantic in August is the birthplace of massive storm fronts, hurricanes that form in the cold troughs of undersea gorges, weather patterns colliding, temperature and moisture forming huge pockets of low pressure. Global forces conspiring, barbarian hordes with clubs and war paint who charge shrieking into the fray, and instantly the sky thickens, blackens, an ominous gale of lightning strikes, huge claps of thunder like the screams of battle, and the sea, which moments ago was calm, turns to hell on earth. Scott swims in the fragile calm, trying to empty his mind. Something brushes against his leg. He freezes, starts to sink, then has to kick his legs to stay afloat. Shark, he thinks. You have to stay still. But if he stops moving, he'll drown. He rolls over onto his back, breathing deeply to inflate his chest. He has never been more aware of his tenuous place on the food chain. Every instinct in his body screams at him not to turn his back on the deep, but he does. He floats in the sea as calmly as he can, rising and falling with the tide.
What are we doing? The boy asks.
Resting, Scott tells him. Let's be real quiet now, okay? Don't move. Try to keep your feet out of the water.
The boy is silent. They rise and fall with the swells. Scott's primal reptilian brain orders him to flee, but he ignores it. A shark can smell a drop of blood in a million gallons of water. If either Scott or the boy is bleeding, they're done. But if not, and they stay completely still, the shark, if it was a shark, should leave them alone. He takes the boy's hand.
Where's my sister?
The boy whispers.
I don't know, Scott whispers back. The plane went down. We got separated.
A long beat.
Maybe she's okay, Scott whispers. Maybe your parents have her. And they're floating someplace else. Or maybe they've already been rescued.
After a long silence, the boy says,
I don't think so.
They float for a while with this thought. Overhead, the fog begins to dissipate. It starts slowly, the clearing. First, a hint of sky peeking through. Then, stars appear. And finally, the crescent moon. And just like that, the ocean around them becomes a sequined dress. From his back, Scott finds the North Star, confirms that they're going in the right direction. He looks over at the boy, eyes wide with fear. For the first time, Scott can see his tiny face, the furrowed brow and bowed mouth.
Hi, says Scott, water lapping at his ears.
The boy's expression is flat, serious.
Hi,
he says back.
Are we rested? Scott says.
The boy nods.
Okay, says Scott, turning over. Let's go home.
He rights himself and starts to swim, certain that at any moment he will feel a strike from below, the razor grip of a steam shovel mouth. But it doesn't come, and after a while he puts the shark out of his mind. He wills them forward, stroke after stroke, his legs moving behind him in figure eights, his right arm lunging and pulling, lunging and pulling. To keep his mind busy, he thinks of other liquids he would rather be swimming in. Milk. Soup. Bourbon. An ocean of bourbon.
He considers his life, but the details seem meaningless now. His ambitions, the rent that is due every month, the woman who has left him. He thinks of his work, brushstrokes on canvas. It is the ocean.